I'm going to add a little stuff to what I would normally cover in this little session, but what I cover here is something that's not peculiarly Austrian, but that I think Austrians would have great sympathy for certainly the arguments that I'm putting forth here, and that has to do with wealth redistribution, domestic and international. So I want to look at a little, and focusing in the domestic side on the U.S., if you're interested in, well, what about the Scandinavian welfare state problem? I can give you some leads on that, but it'll have to be after I come back from signing away my house. So, but I do have some answers for that, because that is sort of the trump card. Well, this goes to show that this can work, and what's the matter with you, and so on. It really doesn't, actually. And in fact, I have a book coming out in October. It's just a book of essays. I didn't write the essays. I just wrote the introduction that the Intercollegiate Studies Institute is putting out, and they're calling it Back on the Road to Serfdom. Yeah, that's an all right title, I guess. And there's an essay in there on the Scandinavian welfare state that I think pretty well puts that to rest. All right, but what I want to do is start off with, as I normally do here, by referring to a book that probably you guys haven't read because it would be a little bit before your time. It's from 1985. And I actually didn't mean that as a joke, but I think about that. This makes me really sad that, that you know, I might conceivably have read that book, although I would have been only 13 at the time. But I did read a lot of dorky books when I was a kid. And the book is by a guy named Charles Murray, who's still around. He's still alive, writing, kicking around. And he wrote this book called Losing Ground, subtitle American Social Policy, 1950 to 1980. This is the 10th anniversary edition that I have. And it's got a couple of shoes on the cover. What do you think the significance of the shoes is? I have no idea, actually. That was a trick question. I don't even know what. I think this actually might have been a mistake. This is supposed to go on some other book. But this became a sort of a classic of the literature, and yet was loathed, was despised beyond words in certain quarters. I mean, certainly by typical sociologists and policy analysts. This was viewed as, I mean, this really, you have to hold up a crucifix to it and make it go away. It's just awful. They were appalled by it. And the reason is the thesis is so far outside what at that time was considered mainstream. And the thesis basically runs as follows, that what we've noticed since the late 1960s, when really the funding for the major anti-poverty programs began to pick up, is that we've seen the poverty level stagnate. That poverty had come down by about a percentage point per year from around 1950 to 1968, and then it just sort of levels off. And what Murray argues is that the leveling off, as opposed to a continuing series of successes, the leveling off occurred not in spite of all these wonderful anti-poverty programs, but because of them. That the anti-poverty programs themselves were responsible for the fact that we were having less and less success against poverty. Now that, as you can, I'm sure, understand, came as some kind of lightning bolt out of nowhere. And what Murray argues here, I mean, he gives a lot of empirical evidence to try to bolster his claims, but he also makes a theoretical case at the beginning. That's what I want to at least begin by summarizing. He argues that it's essentially impossible to devise a wealth transfer program that does not produce net harm. And in effect, he's going to challenge the reader. You try and think one up. Think up a wealth distribution scheme that does not, in fact, produce net harm. And we're going to go through and see what he means by that. He says, let's take as an example the undesirable habit of cigarette smoking. Let's say that the government decides it wants to eradicate cigarette smoking, so it's going to devise a program to reward people to stop. Now, you'll see, I think, early on, what the analogy is here, because smoking, he's in effect comparing to welfare, because in effect both things are difficult to wean yourself off once you've started them. All right, so how are we going to do this? Well, we have to come up with sufficient inducement to persuade a smoker to stop. And we also have to identify a class of smokers that would qualify for the program. In other words, we can't reward somebody who's only been smoking for 10 minutes and then give them a reward for stopping. We have to deal with people who are sort of chronic smokers. So he's thinking about people maybe who've been smoking a pack a day for 5 years. And then we have to offer those people sufficient inducement. So $2 to stop smoking would not be enough. But on the other hand, it's pretty clear that $2 trillion probably would make anyone stop. But that can't, you know, this side of Zimbabwe, that can't be done. So what can we do? We got to find some number in between 2 and 2 trillion. Now, he decides on $10,000. Now, that's back in 1985, so this would be like an astronomical sum. $10,000, amazing. So $10,000 for quitting smoking and sticking to it for a year. So as I've said, this can't apply to people who just started yesterday. We have to focus on people who have been smoking a pack a day for 5 years. And for the sake of simplicity, we're going to leave aside the possibility might quit and then go back to it or have relapses. We're going to leave that out. So what would happen under this scenario? Well, there are several likely possibilities, all of which would occur simultaneously. For one thing, you'd have people who are in their fourth year and 11th month of smoking. Only an idiot would quit smoking then, right? Keep smoking one more month, you get $10,000. So why would you not do it? You know, why would you not stick with smoking? So they have a very great incentive to continue smoking. What about people who have been smoking 4 years and 10 months? Well, again, not quite as strong, but still a strong incentive to continue. What about people who have been smoking 4 years? You smoke one more year, you get $10,000. All right? So in other words, anybody who falls anywhere between 0 and 5 years has some level, some incentive to continue at some varying level of intensity. Now, it's much more difficult to kick the habit once you've smoked for 5 years. So you might start this, you might even start up smoking because of this program, thinking, well, hey, in 5 years I got 10 grand, so in 5 years I'll just quit. But then when 5 years pass, you realize it's really hard to quit. And what might have seemed like sufficient inducement at the beginning is no longer sufficient once you're hooked on it. Now, what about people who have been smoking a half a pack a day for 5 years? Well, they have an incentive to up the amount that they smoke. Or if they've been smoking 19 cigarettes a day, well, start smoking a pack a day, and then you can qualify for this great reward. Now, you might say, well, are people really going to make decisions on this sort of basis? Are they really going to decide on smoking because of these monetary rewards held before them? Well, yes, I think in many cases they would, and particularly we're talking about the marginal smoker, the guy who, you know, is on the fence, you know, should I smoke or not? And, you know, I mean, all the cool people seem to be smoking, but, you know, I don't know if that's enough. It stinks, it's a stinky habit, but gee, $10,000. So in other words, the marginal smoker, potential smoker, might be induced to come on board by a program like this. So here's the difficulty facing the policy analyst. In order to eradicate a problem such as smoking, you have to devise an inducement that would be sufficient to persuade someone to cease the behavior. But yet, you can't make the inducement so great that it encourages additional people to begin the behavior so that they can put themselves in the condition that qualifies them for the reward. And it turns out that this is actually very difficult to do. And particularly now when we take this analogy and we apply it to welfare programs, social welfare programs, we see the difficulty, which is that human beings naturally are inclined to seek after their ends with the least possible exertion. And if they can get something for free, they're going to tend to do that. So the problem is that the more you induce them to put themselves in a condition that entitles them to a reward, the more people will put themselves in that condition. And so you will get a larger and larger population qualifying for various government benefits on top of an ever-shrinking pool of productive citizens supplying those benefits. And ultimately, the logic of it leads to a crisis. Doesn't need to, but in practice, it tends to. So this is the way Charles Murray himself puts it. He says, if 90% of the population had been smoking for 5 years when the program began, we might still argue that the program would show a net reduction in smoking. But only about 15% of the adult population smokes a pack a day or more. Let us estimate that a third of this number have been smoking at that rate for more than 5 years. If so, our plan has the potential for reducing smoking among 5% of the adult population and the potential for increasing smoking among 95% of the adult population. It is exceedingly difficult to attach numbers to the considerations we have just reviewed without coming to the conclusion that the program as specified would have the net effect of increasing both the number of cigarettes consumed and the number of smokers. Well, then Murray goes on to identify three laws. I mean, these are not praxeological laws, but they're based on broad empirical generalization that I think, by and large, will hold up, that will tend to push the welfare state and that will tend to lead to this kind of undesirable outcome. One of them, the first one he calls the law of imperfect selection, and these are his words. By the law of imperfect selection, he means any objective rule that defines eligibility for a social transfer program will irrationally exclude some persons. Now, when he says any objective rule that defines eligibility for a social transfer program will irrationally exclude some persons, what he has in mind is, for example, today, when you think about people who vote. Now, let's leave aside, you know, oh, I'm a libertarian, I don't believe in voting. I don't care about that for this example. In this example, we can think of many 18-year-olds who really aren't bright enough to be voting. I mean, you could probably think of like, at least like one. On the other hand, we've probably met some 12-year-olds who are more than intelligent enough to vote, cast a good vote. But yet, nevertheless, we have a uniform rule. Well, any such uniform rule is going to exclude somebody like the smart 12-year-old and is going to include somebody like the dumb 18-year-old. This is just the nature of these general rules. Well, likewise, the same kind of difficulty confronts you when you're devising a social welfare program. You are inevitably going to exclude some people who seem deserving, and you're going to include some people who just seem like bums. And there's no way to avoid this. And so the dynamic of the program is that you tend to expand it over time so as to bring in to the program umbrella all those people who have been irrationally excluded simply because of these difficulties that arise when devising general rules. So there will be pressure to say, well, look, this poor guy, now he certainly should qualify. And instead of saying, all right, but this guy really shouldn't, let's get him out, they just say, well, let's broaden the eligibility requirements. Let's bring more and more people in. So there's a tendency built into the system to make it larger and larger. Second law that he identifies, the law of unintended rewards. This one is very obvious from his cigarette example. Any social transfer increases the net value of being in the condition that prompted the transfer. So if you get benefits for being down and out, there is an incentive to be down and out. It doesn't mean, say, that everybody who's down and out did some kind of calculation in his head and said, you know, I think I'll, you know, not try to improve myself just so I can get this money. But the point is that you do, in fact, benefit from being in that condition more than you once did. The program that seeks to change behavior must offer an inducement that unavoidably either adds to the attraction of or reduces the penalties of engaging in the behavior in question. And then finally, the law of net harm. The less likely it is, these are, again, Murray's words, the less likely it is that the unwanted behavior will change voluntarily, the more likely it is that a program to induce change will cause net harm. So that is to say, the more intractable the problem is. When it's something like smoking, which is, again, just meant as an example, but something that people get addicted to, or if it's a lot of the social problems we confront, the more difficult and intractable they are, the more likely it is that programs are likely to actually expand the scope of the problem. And here, let me actually quote from Losing Ground. Okay, let's see. I'm going to read two paragraphs here. It is guaranteed that success rates will be very low. The technology of changing human behavior depends heavily on the use of negative reinforcement in conjunction with positive reinforcement. The more deeply ingrained the behavior to be changed, and the more attractions it holds for the person whose behavior is involved, the more important it is that the program have both a full toolkit available to it and the participant's willingness to go along with whatever is required. The Marine Corps has both these assets. Social programs to deal with the hardcore unemployed, teenaged mothers, delinquents, and addicts seldom do. And then, still more important, second, as inducements become large, as they must if the program is dealing with the most intractable problems, the more attractive they become to people who were not in need of help in the first place. We do not yet know how large they must finally become. We do know from experience, however, that quite generous experimental programs have provided extensive counseling, training, guaranteed jobs, and other supports, and failed. We can only guess at what would be enough. Perhaps a matter of years of full-time residential training, followed by guaranteed jobs at double or triple the minimum wage, we do not know. Whatever they are, however, consider their effects on the people not in the program. At this point, it appears that any program that would succeed in helping large numbers of the hardcore unemployed will make hardcore unemployment a highly desirable state to be in. Okay. Now, just a few sort of observations, empirical observations, about what's happened in the case of the United States. There have been several interesting studies that have been done over the years about trying to isolate what the effects of various forms of welfare programs are on people's willingness to work. Now, again, understanding all the flaws that attend these studies, nevertheless, they have found a clear and unambiguous relationship that people, you know, they get welfare payments, they actually tend to reduce their working hours, and they tend to reduce their efforts at finding work. It's just sort of common sense. But what's also interesting is that Murray argued that these programs help foster the breakup of families, because you don't need the breadwinner in the household anymore when you have a check coming in. And critics have said, well, that's just too much. I mean, really, are you saying that people are making decisions whether or not to get married, whether or not to stay together on the basis of some crummy government program? Could that really be? But it's interesting that when a series of income maintenance experiments was conducted in the 1970s, I think into the early 1980s, they were called the Seattle and Denver income maintenance experiments, but they were actually conducted over a wide variety of cities. They found that there was a noticeable effect. They found that, in fact, family breakup occurred at much higher rates under these programs than otherwise, except in Gary, Indiana. And so researchers want to know, how come in Gary, Indiana, we don't see this family breakup effect? And when they inquired, they found out that people in Gary had been mistakenly told that they would lose their benefits if they broke up their marriages. Well, I mean, that, you know, there could have been offsetting factors here, but that does seem, on the surface of it, to indicate some kind of relationship here. All right. Now, of course, there are anti-poverty programs that we start to see, you know, you can see them throughout American history. They pick up a little bit in the 1930s. There's a minimum wage program, which, of course, is not really an anti-poverty program. It's more of a pro-union program. That's another issue. There's the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program in the 1930s, which was supposed to help basically widows who were, you know, were young widows who were desperate, who just had no means of support and who had young children. And this was a very minor federal program. By the 1960s, the eligibility requirements for that program are greatly expanded, such that vast numbers of people begin to qualify for them. In the 1960s, particularly under Lyndon Johnson, we see an acceleration of the welfare state, both in size and scope. This is, of course, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, War on Poverty programs. And so you see various programs instituted that aim to improve people's condition by improving access to education, to job training, medical care. And Aid to Families with Dependent Children, or AFDC, being liberalized is part and parcel of that. But what's the record of these programs? Now, this is something that, to some degree, I talk a little bit about in the Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, and then I can give references for where some of these figures come from. I was not actually allowed to use footnotes in that book. All my other books are super-duper footnoted, except that one. That's because the publisher didn't want footnotes because they thought it would look too scholarly and they wanted it to be a book that people would pick up and read for fun. And then after that, all the other ones were allowed to use footnotes. So now it just looks like I am a sinister person who just makes stuff up and then runs away. So if you want to know where this stuff comes from, I can give you all the sources. But one of these Great Society programs involved something called the Elementary and Secondary Education Act in 1965. And Title I of that act specifically earmarks federal spending to education of poor children and increasing resources available to them. But yet it turns out that the billions of dollars devoted to that appear to have had no results, or at least the outcomes are unchanged. The government's own studies found that within a year, any gains that were made were lost by the next year. Like whatever extra you might have learned, everybody seems to have forgot about by the time they show up for third grade. They forgot with the extra stuff from the second grade. And it seemed like that beyond a certain level, you can just keep, you know, you can have a solid gold school building. You can have a, you know, computer planted in everybody's brain. And ultimately, at some level of spending, you just stop seeing any additional results. And that level seems to be pretty low, that you start you stop seeing any real results. It seems to be peer influences, home environment, community, all the sorts of common sense things that you think would either encourage or discourage academic excellence seem to trump federal programs. The introduction of Medicaid and Medicare, Medicaid means tested for the poor, Medicare for the elderly, were also features of the Great Society programs. And when we look at the before and after, we note that the hospital admission rates of poor people at the time, just on the eve of the introduction of these programs, was just about the same. I mean, the poor went to the hospital slightly less, but roughly the same. I mean, not some kind of gross disparity, certainly. And what we also notice is that in the wake of the program, what the program seemed to have done is transferred wealth from middle-class taxpayers to middle-class health professionals. Because what had happened in the past was that medical care was provided to the poor. I mean, this is hard for us to believe. This is like something from Mars or something, especially because most of us weren't alive at the time. But believe it or not, it was taken for granted that as a physician, you have a responsibility to provide low-cost or free medical care to people who desperately need it. And so that was indeed done without any government gun in the ribs. This was done. Everyone understood this. This is part of the honorable profession of medicine. This, by and large, comes to an end. This is supplanted by these government programs. Well, what's the point of my providing these services anymore if the government's doing it? So this just drops out. So what has been argued, and this is argued in a book by Alan, and you want to say Matuso, but apparently he pronounces it Matusow. Well, that's up to him. But Matusow, Alan, Allen. Alan Matusow has this book called The Unraveling of America, and it's a sort of a history of the 60s. And he's not a free market guy or anything, but he just comes out and says this. He says, "It doesn't seem that the amount of medical care, the quality of medical care, doesn't seem to make a huge difference here. Like, people were already getting this type of care previously." And I'll say more about Medicare in a minute when I talk about the situation we're facing right now. Then there's the job training programs. Now, Mark Thornton, who's also a senior fellow here at the Mises Institute, was telling me not long ago about a study that was done of some state, and I don't know if it was Alabama, I can't remember which state it was, but it was a study that was done of the state-level job training programs and how many people went through these programs, finished them successfully, and then found a job in the field for which the program had trained them. And the answer was one. One person in a year met all those requirements, which it doesn't seem like I was arbitrarily trying to make this difficult for them to jump through these hoops. Well, likewise, the federal job training programs. What's funny is that the federal government doesn't actually know how many job training programs it has. When they're asked about this, you get all different answers, 24, 12, 30. Like, you don't actually get the same. Like, they don't even know. Like, no one's even checking. But the Job Corps was the major one. This one's still around in spite of the fact it has exactly zero to show for itself. But since most people don't know that, politicians just boast that, hey, I increased Job Corps spending for my constituents here. All right, well, it turns out that the amount of money that's spent on a Job Corps recipient would send that person to Harvard for a year. And yet, when they've looked at what were the results, well, they compared the results of people who went through the Job Corps program to people who were accepted into the program, so met the requirements, but never showed up. So it turns out that people who went through the program successfully, compared with no-shows, there's no difference in terms of the wages they ultimately get for the jobs they get. There's no difference at all. So all this like it has nothing whatsoever to show for it. And we don't even need to talk about the stabbings, the riots, the things I don't even want to mention in this room. That's not even necessary to talk about that. Just on the face of it, the numbers. But it's also worth noting that 2/3 of people who got into the Job Corps, like you're accepted into this free job training program, this is going to give you skills to go out there and get a job, 2/3 of the people didn't even bother to finish it. Now, I realize that this is a hate crime even to suggest, but when 2/3 of people don't even bother to finish a free job training program, you think maybe we're starting to get to the root of why they're having trouble finding work? I mean, maybe there might be something, some connection here, but I don't know. I mean, we all know that everything's arbitrary and, you know, there's no connection to effort. You're just stuck because of the capitalist system. And shame on me for saying that. All right. Now then in 1996, we had the, I think it was 96, Bill Clinton got rid of the AFDC program and replaced it with TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, which puts a 5-year cap on how long you can be on it, and it gives the states more leeway in administering these programs. And people screamed about this at the time, especially Republicans screamed about it because they said, well, he's stealing our issues. Yeah, but interestingly, he actually did cut something, which is a kind of a refreshing change as compared with the Republicans. So people were saying, welfare has been abolished by Bill Clinton. He abolished welfare. Yeah. Well, AFDC was about 6% of federal welfare spending. So when you continue 94% of the spending, that's not actually discontinuing. So you still have feeding and nutrition programs. You still have the job training. In fact, Clinton increased funding for the Job Corps. I mean, need we even point that out? Food stamps. Women, infants, and children, housing subsidies, educational programs, daycare programs, and so on. Those were still there. Okay, and then combined with all this in the late 60s was the development of something that had been germinating for some time, which is the welfare rights philosophy, by which we began to hear that welfare recipients need to think of themselves as indeed being entitled to what they're receiving. And not think of it as, you know, kind of a nice charitable exercise on the part of their fellow citizens, but something that they are owed in strict justice. Now, this obviously changes the whole dynamic of things. And, of course, this is based on the idea that the system is rigged against you. So it has nothing, your condition has zero to do with you, not even 5%. It has nothing to do with you. It's just the system is rigged against you. So, therefore, of course you're owed this in strict justice. People who benefit from the system ought to share some of their wealth with people who are unjustly condemned to poverty by it. And so the welfare rights philosophy begins to develop. And this, of course, this completely turns community values upside down. Because up to now, the guy in the community who just kept on working, even though he could accept various payments, and there were numerous states in which the whole collection of benefits, if you add them up all together, would be as good as, you know, a $12 or $13 an hour job, even in the 1990s, but in $1990, this changes things. Charles Murray calls these status rewards, that you would at least in the old days have been respected as being a guy who is not a charge on his fellow citizens, but who works in spite of the fact that, you know, he could throw himself on their mercy, but he chooses not to. So this is what Murray says. Once these highly functional sources of status, that is the fact that I'm self-supporting and hardworking, are removed, the vaunted work ethic becomes highly vulnerable. The notion that there is an intrinsic good in working, even if one does not have to, may have impressive philosophical credentials, but on its face it is not very plausible, at least not to a young person whose values are still being formed. To someone who is not yet persuaded of the satisfactions of making one's way, there is something laughable about a person who doggedly keeps working at a lousy job for no tangible reason at all. And when working no longer provides either income or status, the last reason for working has truly vanished. The man who keeps working is, in fact, a chump. Now, some people have tried to argue that the explosion in welfare cases had nothing to do with the welfare rights philosophy, the expansion of eligibility requirements, but simply a lack of jobs. What do you expect these people to do? There aren't any jobs. Fred Siegel writes, "Talk to intelligent urbanites in New York, Los Angeles, or Washington about welfare, and almost the first thing they'll tell you is that people are on welfare because of an absence of jobs. When you point out that the welfare explosion in America not only began in New York, but also coincided with the great economic and jobs boom of the 1960s, when black unemployment in the city was running at 4%, about half the national average for minorities, they look puzzled and tend to change the subject. New York City was very liberal in its welfare policy in the 1960s. Between 1945 and 1960, on the eve of this liberalization, in that 15-year period, the number of people on welfare in New York City grew by 47,000. But over the next 5 years, through 1965, it grew by more than 200,000 in just that 5-year period. And by 1971, after we have just experienced one of the most prosperous periods in U.S. history, there were 1,165,000 people on welfare in New York City, which at that time was larger than the entire populations of 15 states. Also, in the prosperous 1980s and 1990s, jobs available in great abundance, and yet the poverty level still stagnates. Well, maybe these jobs are too difficult. They require skills that most people don't have. Well, jobs requiring basic secretarial skills were going unfilled for lack of qualified applicants. Some very good paying jobs required little more than that the applicant understand the concept of 75% and be able to divide 100 by 4. Now, these are people who got 12 years of free so-called education, at least, and I guess plus kindergarten. You got all these years of... Now, if education had been privately funded and the result was a potential labor force this pathetic, well, of course, we'd never hear the end of it. Well, this goes to show why we need government education. Like, there's no way they can lose. Like, they win no matter what happens. If it stinks, they win. If it's good, they win. All right. Well, anyway, I want to just finally say, before saying something about the international level, something about the condition of things now, because we hear all these fantastic numbers regarding unfunded liabilities, which are tied to programs like Social Security and Medicare. Well, the situation is pretty dire, and this is not a matter of an incorrigible naysayer or pessimist talking here. I mean, this is inevitable. The reason it's inevitable that we're going to have a crash of the system, that it has to break down, the reason it's inevitable involves the aging of the U.S. population and the Western population as a whole, but also including countries like Japan. Japan is experiencing and going through it right now, the most severe aging crisis perhaps that we've ever seen, ever. And by age, what I'm talking about is that we've got a lot of countries that are not reproducing at replacement level. Replacement level means keeping the population stable without immigration, so that the native population can reproduce itself and stay stable. You have to be at 2.1 children per couple to be at replacement level. The U.S. right now is at 2.0. Other countries, like in Europe, I mean, you've got Italy and Spain around 1.3 and 1.1. Other European, I mean, there's no European country that's at replacement level as far as I know. I mean, maybe in Eastern Europe, I don't think so. I don't think there's anybody that's close to it. So what's happening is that because of improvements in medical technology and medical knowledge, people's life expectancy is increasing at a time when the number of new births coming up to support these people in their old age is declining, and at really quite astonishing rates. So we're seeing a dramatic expansion in what some demographers call the old old. The old old is people 85 and older. That demographic is skyrocketing. Over the next 3 to 4 decades in the U.S., we're going to see the number of people aged 100 and over increase by 13 times. The old old, that is people 85 and older will grow by 240%. And the young old is between 65 and 84, they're going to increase by about 80%. Now, this is not something to be deplored that, you know, we hate people and it's not that, I mean, you know, good people's life expectancy is increasing, but of course the medical expenses associated with people at these advanced ages is much greater. I mean, as much as three times or more can multiply very dramatically. So the reason this is inevitable is that these people have already been born. These people who are going to hit these ages have already been born. So we merely extrapolate from an existing population. We don't have to devise doomsday scenarios. This is the doomsday scenario. It's already working itself out very, very slowly. And now because Japan is already enduring it, we can watch what happens. Now Japan, unlike the U.S., has a cultural tradition whereby young children understand, you know, from an early age that they will care for their elders later on. They'll care for their extended family. There'll be an extended family unit. Whereas in the U.S., there is this sort of view that I have a natural right to just forget about all my relatives when I reach a certain age. That's going to be tricky to deal with this when this happens. So Japan is seeing an explosion in people who are in the super, super old. And my favorite example of this, it really sort of exemplifies this, was not long ago there was this is true. There's a woman who was pulled over because she was riding her motorcycle too fast. And she's 100 years old. And they said to her, well, you know, you got to slow down. You got to wear your helmet. You got to wear a helmet when you're riding a motorcycle. And she said, I'm sorry, my son on the back of the motorcycle here, he's wearing my helmet. Her son was 79. And the two of them are, I mean, you know, God love these people really at some level, but the average Japanese woman who reaches age 65 will live on average until age 85. So this is a major issue. And so a lot of the countries where we hear boasting about their wonderful state-run medical program, well, even before you get into the rationing and the waiting and all that stuff, the fact is that this guy named Pete Peterson, who, don't laugh at his name, he's at the time that he was writing the books that he wrote a book in 1999, then came out in paperback in 2000 called Gray Dawn, and then he wrote again following up on this in called Running on Empty in 2005. Pete Peterson was the head of the CFR, Council on Foreign Relations. So he's a, yeah, I know. But I mean, so he's a very influential and extremely wealthy person. He doesn't have to write books like this. The point is that he's well-connected. So I believe him when he tells me that he's spoken to people running the treasuries in various major countries around the world, particularly in Europe, and they have said to him, yes, this is a train wreck, and it is going to happen. Everything's going to explode. Yes, our much-vaunted medical systems, of course, are going to be overwhelmed. Of course we can't cope with this. They won't say this publicly, though, because it's not going to occur on their watch. But privately, they say, yeah, of course, we all know this is going to collapse. And so that's why it's kind of funny to read people in this healthcare debate saying, we need to get with the program and be like Europe and whatever. Hello? Those people are jumping ship as quickly as possible, right? I mean, the people who run these countries are already dealing with, you know, how are they going to have dual citizenship so they can get the heck out when the collapse comes? I mean, like, it's like people don't even realize this is happening. It's happening right right in front of them. So this is an inevitable part of our future. How are we going to deal with it? Well, there have been various blue ribbon commissions set up. Every blue ribbon commission ever in history is ignored. That's one of Woods's laws. All blue ribbon commissions are ignored. Now, it's like Rothbard's laws in that once in a while there's an exception, but by and large, blue ribbon commissions are ignored. So every 15 years since about 1955, we've had a blue ribbon commission about military acquisitions and how shot through with corruption they are and price inflation that goes on, and we got to do something. And every 15 years, they have the same recommendations. None of them ever get done. Everyone forgets the Blue Ribbon Commission until 15 years later. Well, same thing with this. They've tried and tried and tried. There was one in 1994 under Bill Clinton looking into the entitlement situation. Now, all this Blue Ribbon Commission did was just look into the problem of growth in entitlements. Because right now, according to Richard Fisher, who's the head of the Dallas Fed, The unfunded liabilities, we're looking at a figure of nearly $100 trillion. Now that, you know, that's not going to be paid. Like that, you can just, that's just not going to happen. So in 1994, there was this look at, well, what exactly should be done? So the commission just prepared a report detailing the cost projections for the various entitlement programs. Before reforms were even proposed, all they had done was publish cost projections. The people on the commission had received 350,000 pre-formatted, outraged postcards from seniors. So no matter how completely impossible it is to maintain benefit levels where they are, and no matter how unjust it is to the younger population, the issue can't even be discussed. Nice. Now again, I don't mean to disparage all people who are older, but I am reminded of the Simpsons episode where Grandpa's walking down the street saying, talking about the Democrats and all these young people all wanting a handout, what's the matter with them? And he then shows him walking into the Social Security office and he says, I'm old, gimme, gimme, gimme. All right, let me take my remaining bit of time to say something about what has happened with regard to wealth distribution on an international level, like foreign aid and all this. I guess I once said I would support foreign aid only if I hated the human race. And there's now a Facebook group with that name. Don't join it. Nothing ever happens. Like, we've all forgot. We just think it's cool to have on our profile, but nobody ever does anything there, I don't think. But foreign aid is one of these things that, you know, you think, well, I mean, how would you be against this, right? You're going to help starving people. But see, you're not really. That's the thing. You're really not actually helping starving people. You're helping regimes. That's always how it works. The regimes get the money. And so there was a guy who predicted everything that was going to come down as a result of this debacle, and that was Peter Bauer, B-A-U-E-R, who taught at London and Cambridge over the course of his career. He won a major, major award and honor in the 1990s, the Milton Friedman Award, which carries, I think, a $500,000 prize because he had been vindicated. And then I think he dropped dead like almost immediately, like almost right after. So the poor guy, right, his whole life, he's, you know, people spit on him and say, oh, you hate the poor. Then finally he persuades everybody. But at least he lived to see that people were suddenly saying, you know, maybe these programs don't really work so well, but no one could have predicted that they would work so badly. That's, again, that's the other refrain, right? Whenever there's a big, big failure, the refrain will be, no one could have predicted this. So we all know that's true of the current situation. Well, they all said this. The New York Times in the 1990s, yep, these programs had the best of intentions, but they just didn't work. But you can't blame us because no one could have seen it. And meanwhile, Bauer's in the back of the room going, hello, I mean, you know, right here. I mean, what do you think I've been doing my whole freaking career, you idiots, trying to talk to you people? So that actually, I'm sorry to have a digression, forgive me, but it actually does remind me of Robert Conquest, the great British historian of the Soviet Union, who had been writing about the crimes of communism, and he had been he'd just been condemned and excoriated by the left for exaggerating these crimes. And so when the updated edition of his book, The Great Terror, was going to be published, the publisher asked him, would you like to update the title as well? And he said, yes, I'd like to call it, I Told You So, I Told You So, You Blanking Fools. That's what he wanted to name the new edition. So Bauer could have named any of his books this. So we go through and we see the World Bank, the IMF, in the 1990s, they're all admitting that these things have been a disaster, that poverty has gotten worse, that if you look at the countries that have improved, they're the ones that have been weaned off foreign aid. If you look at Taiwan or Chile or just look all around the world, look at Hong Kong, fantastic prosperity, even though some of these places have no natural resources to speak of. They've, just from an absolute standard point of view, seem to have shortages of things and water and energy sources, and yet they're flourishing. So, you know, what the heck is going on here? It's also been documented that, in fact, there was an article in the American Economic Review in 2002 that argued that increases in foreign aid are associated with increases in corruption, and that corruption is positively correlated with aid received from the United States. Parade magazine a few years ago published a ranking of the 20 worst dictators in power, and it was discovered that 19 of them were getting aid from the U.S. But the thought was, well, you know, but they're going to put this to good purposes, you see. I mean, they're going to, I mean, the money, it says in the memo part of the check, give this to the people, right? It's right in there on the check, so surely. And in fact, it didn't actually turn out. What in fact happens, these regimes, as you could predict, they build up fiefdoms, they reward their own favored constituencies, you know, kind of like they do here in this country. But the point is that it actually entrenches them in power. It allows them to delay necessary reforms because they can give the external appearance of prosperity. They can invest in white elephant sort of industries, like industries where there's no hope that their country could ever compete. But hey, look at this giant factory. That's really great, like the biggest factory on the whole continent. We bought it with the money that we got. Okay, well, given that now we're seeing this, what was it that Peter Bauer was saying? Like, what was he warning about? Like, how did he know that this was going to end in tears? Like, how did he know that in case after case after case of foreign aid recipients, the result was going to be stagnation or worse, poverty, growing corruption, hopelessness? How did he know this? Well, for one thing, he evaluated and scrutinized the arguments that were made on behalf of these programs and found that none of them held up. The most common one was called the vicious circle, not cycle, but vicious circle of poverty. Basically went like this. We all know that you want to have capital investment in your country because the more capital you have per capita, the higher the real wages that people will enjoy. So you want to engage in capital investment to the extent possible. But you're going to need to save first. You know, investment comes out of savings. You need high savings rate that can make possible the investment, that makes possible increases in prosperity, that makes possible further additions to the stock of savings, which makes possible further capital accumulation in a virtuous cycle of prosperity. But what happens when you start off dirt poor? You don't have the accumulated savings, you can't ever get the cycle going. So you have low capital investment, which means low wages, which means a low ability to save, which means low capital investment, and it goes on in a vicious circle of poverty. And so this is why we need foreign aid, because foreign aid will break into the circle, because this will give the infusion of capital that these countries need. That's the argument. Well, one of the main answers that Bauer gave to this was, well, if that's true, how did any country ever become prosperous? Weren't they all stuck in a vicious circle of poverty initially? Like, when mankind first appeared on this earth, it wasn't like there was already one rich country who could then lend or give money to the other ones. They're all poor. So unless, you know, green spacemen came and lent money to the first one, like, how did the first one ever get rich? In other words, why aren't we all still in the Stone Age? And Bauer said that. If your argument about the vicious circle is correct, we should all still be in the Stone Age. But we're not. Therefore, your argument is wrong. He says, there is not a single instance in history when external donations were required for the economic development of a country. Economic prosperity, he said, depends on people's attributes, attitudes, motivations, mores, and political arrangements. And part of that, of course, is culture, cultural beliefs. If you believe in fatalism, you know, you're not going to believe in entrepreneurial risk-taking and so on. If the conditions for development, this again is Bauer, other than capital are present, the capital required will either be generated locally or be available commercially from abroad to governments or to businesses. That's how they'll get it. But if the required conditions are not present, then aid will be ineffective and wasted. Then, of course, there are institutional factors at work. Obviously, if entrepreneurship is blocked at every turn, this is going to lead to poverty. So, for example, Hernando de Soto, whose book, The Mystery of Capital, I don't like at all, but whose book, The Other Path on Peru, has got some valuable insights, because he points out, studying Peru, why is Peru so poor? He says, well, if you want to start a small clothing factory in Peru, here's all you have to do. You have to engage in, and to get through the regulatory barriers, a mere 289 work days worth of work to comply with the regulations, fill out 81 meters of forms, and commit 8 overt bribes. That's all. Yeah, and see, they say the free market is the system for rich people. Well, no, see, you'd have to be a rich person to comply with that. See, in a free market, you could just open your own, you know, you could have be a hot dog peddler or whatever and just go into business. But how many poor people can go into business under that sort of situation? All right, well, then there are arguments that we need infrastructure money. And again, presumably this could be generated in ways other than government-to-government grants, but infrastructure money, this will give us a great advance in productivity levels that we see in these countries. Jeffrey Sachs, who was at Columbia, Jeffrey Sachs, whom in a less professional environment I once referred to as a fathead, but today this is a purely just on the level kind of presentation, but because he got smacked down by some great hedge fund guy, but we'll talk about that later. Anyway, Sachs has this argument that we need this. We will get a big push in public investments essential to ending poverty in Africa. If we commit ourselves to it and we get these countries on board, we're going to see great steps, strides forward in productivity. Well, Bill Easterly, who used to be at the World Bank, then published a book called The Elusive Quest for Growth, arguing that everything the World Bank was doing was a big fiasco. And then he resigned from the World Bank. He was not forced out, you understand. It was just a mere coincidence that he resigned right around the time that he smashed them. But then he went to NYU. And here's what Easterly says about Sachs. Sachs said that large aid increases would finance, quote, a big push in public investments to produce a rapid step increase in Africa's underlying productivity, both rural and urban. Over 1970 to 94, there is good data on public investment for 22 African countries. These countries' governments spent $342 billion on public investment. The donors gave these same countries' governments $187 billion in aid over this period. Unfortunately, the corresponding step increase in productivity, measured as per capita growth over this period, was zero. That's kind of a shame. Well, then, now the most recent argument. Oh, and I might point out another thing that's been said is, didn't the Marshall Plan, which was an infusion of outside aid, didn't that help Western Europe recover from the effects of World War II? Well, likewise, can't we just reproduce that in Africa? And not like Africa is the only poor place, but Africa is usually given as an example. And part of the answer is, well, if you look at the equivalent sums spent, Africa has already received like half a dozen Marshall Plans already. So that's already been done. But secondly, on the Marshall Plan, there's one thing you need to read. And I used to put it up on the board, but it's a really long, complicated URL PDF thing. So I'm going to give you the shortcut. No one was using the domain name learnaustrianeconomics.com, so I grabbed it. So if you go to learnaustrianeconomics.com, there's a foreign aid section on there, which is not, again, particularly Austrian per se, but has some Austrian insights. There's a chapter by Tyler Cowen there. So I think it's one of the best things he's ever done on the myths of the Marshall Plan. You should read that, because that will shut down discussion there. So what we start to hear now in recent years is that what really needs to be done is if only we could target the aid appropriately. If we could, you know, sure, we don't want to send aid to really bad people. We'll just send the aid to the good people. And then we can make this into a good program. But the problem with the aid, of course, is that it's a bad. It's not like a good program gone bad. It is a bad. Because the incentive structure created by the program encourages people to devote less time to the satisfaction of consumer demand and more time to agitating for a share of the grant money. There are at least a dozen countries, and I've talked about foreign aid in my 33 Questions book and in my Church in the Market book, and I pointed out that there are at least a dozen countries where violence has broken out, particularly ethnically based violence, as each group tries to grab for itself a share of the aid money. So it encourages all the wrong incentives. It builds up the parasitic sector at the expense of the smooth functioning of the private sector. So it's a bad in and of itself, but we get told all the time that, and particularly these days, that this is what we need, is just target the aid better, target it to countries where the president doesn't eat people, for instance. Then it'll work. The problem with this is that this has been said, well, the problem is not only that the programs are bad in and of themselves, but this has been said, like, it's like they've had a blue ribbon commission on this year after year. Because let me just quote. Here's 1963, John F. Kennedy. Objective number one, to apply stricter standards of selectivity in aiding developing countries. Well, that's just been a super success. Then 6 years later, the Pearson Commission says exactly the same thing. In 1985, the CASN Development Committee Task Force on Foreign Aid, parentheses, which will have no effect on anything. I added that part in. They didn't actually put that in there. Declared that the relief of poverty depends both on aid and on the policies of the recipient countries. Well, good job, genius. Whoever, you never guessed that. Really? The policy of the recipient countries might have some effect on it? There's another report in 1992. Even very well-designed projects cannot succeed in a poor policy environment. Well, indeed. And yet, these things have consistently been failures. And yet, if you look at where in the world do we see prosperous countries? Well, we see them in places where property and contract rights are relatively secure, and in places where those things are not secure, and they're constantly being invaded by the state apparatus, you see poverty. This is not, you know, it doesn't require brain surgery. People need advice, and they need outside aid in the form of private aid from people who have surveyed the situation, understand what's going on, understand what the prospects for growth are, and don't just want to throw money at whatever some regime wants to devote it to arbitrarily, but would say, well, this particular project, under these particular conditions, is likely to turn a profit, so we'll invest in it. There really is no substitute for that. Finally, in the Journal of Economic Affairs, we have this, I think, useful insight. Aid dependency alters incentives and strategies. By the way, I think this statement applies domestically and internationally. Creating a political economy entrenched in every fiber of society where additional wealth is easiest created by more aid, not by reforms or producing more efficiently. Aid dependency dilutes the very same process that makes societies affluent. It hampers the true source of wealth creation, namely behavioral change. Well, that is a little bit of an overview of some of the scholarly work that's been done in this area. It runs very much contrary to the conventional wisdom. But in this day and age, that is the beginning of true wisdom. So thank you very much, and I'll talk to you after lunch, okay?